Good afternoon and welcome to Mediascope, the programme for and about the public relations, event management and journalism industries. I'm Ellen Gunning and you're very welcome to the programme, which is sponsored by the Irish Academy of Public Relations. It's all about money this week. Later, I'll be talking to Paul Davis about his new book, which shows business people how to earn more money and spend less time doing it. First, though, I want to chat with Lucy Masterson about how to raise money for good causes. Lucy Masterson, Fundraising Ireland, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Now, congratulations, you've taken over the reins at Fundraising Ireland since August of last year.
That's right, yes. So I'm just here 6 months into the new role and have to say it's working within the charity sector is fantastic, but it's like learning a new language because I've come from a commercial background. So, yeah.
What's the biggest difference, just as a curiosity?
I think the biggest difference is where in a commercial setup, you're very much so geared towards the outcomes and bottom line and profit. And that's how you're measured by success. And so when that translates to the charity sector, you're dealing with, I suppose, your outcomes are social. It's very, very difficult to measure your outcomes. So you're generating money and you're generating revenue, but instead of ploughing that back into this, into the shareholders and the bottom line, you're actually ploughing that back into the cause and into actually improving people's lives and providing services that are vitally needed. So it's difficult to measure that and demonstrate the actual impact and the outcome of the work that you're doing when you're working within the charity sector.
Fair point, actually, and it is a very big difference. I know one of the things that you've been working on, I'm not sure if it started before you joined or not, is a new sort of a code. Where you're putting together a code to do what? To put an ethical framework, not an ethical framework on fundraising, or is it?
So, well, yes, absolutely. Because, so I suppose we were, in 2013, the sector was left reeling after the you know, rehab and the whole CRC scandal. So, you know, but every cloud, I suppose, has a silver lining. And since then, a charity regulator has been appointed. And as a sector, we know that we need to regulate and be able to be fully transparent to all the stakeholders and to the public and to those who donate to us. And part of that, and a vital part of that, is how we fundraise. And for many charities, they need to fundraise to raise the vital funds for their organisations. But in Ireland, would you believe, there is actually no formal training in fundraising. So you can go to a university and you can learn and have a third degree training and development programme in nearly anything in within the professional landscape today, with the exception of fundraising. So at fundraising...
So there's neither a hands-on for the people who go out physically and raise the funds, nor is there a strategic fundraising course?
No. So at Fundraising Ireland, what we do is we provide training in how to do professional, ethical and best practice fundraising. Now, part of that, you need to have a set of codes by which you can gauge and measure yourself. So so what exists at the moment, and partly what the government funded, there is in existence a statement of guiding principles for fundraising that organisations, charitable organisations, sign up to. And that says, as an organisation, we are committed to best practice and we are committed to professional ethical fundraising. But really, it's quite difficult for the individual fundraiser within those organisations. So what does that mean? So if I'm organising a bag pack in a supermarket, if I'm organising a street collection, if I'm organising a direct marketing campaign, how actually do I need to act and behave in a professional and ethical way in terms of raising and generating that revenue? And that's what the code of practice for fundraisers sets out to do.
It's a big challenge.
It is, but it's absolutely vital, because for charities who are fundraising the vital funds that they need, they want and need to be accountable and to be able to demonstrate to those who are giving to them that this is how we're raising the money and this is what we're doing with your money. So those codes are very, very important. So we're in the final stages of development of these codes. And we're hoping...
I presume, sorry for cross-talking, it will kick in at both ends then. For the likes of the chuggers, to use that awful expression, that people meet on the street, there will be codes about how they can stop people or how they can interact with people to raise funds?
Yeah, and I mean, the face-to-face fundraisers have a really, you know, they get a really tough time of it, because as a form of fundraising, for charities, this kind of face-to-face interaction and people signing up through a direct debit or to pay and to support their charities on a monthly basis is so valuable. It's like a lifeblood for a lot of the charities in how they engage and how they sign people up to support charities. So the guys and the girls who are talking to you on the street, it's a really hard job for them. There is guidelines around how they need to be trained and how they need to interact with the public. And so these codes are just there really to support and underpin that as well.
And at the other end then, at the senior level where you're looking at the most senior people in a charity and how charities are run, I'm actually thinking about the Irish Cancer Society over the last couple of weeks and the whole debate about cutting services or cutting funding to people versus the amount of money that their chief executive and their senior staff are paid. The fundraising code, will it actually influence in any way the sort of salaries within the sector, or will it influence only the percentage that goes back?
No, well, I think the CEO salaries is a completely kind of, I suppose, separate issue. I mean, in Ireland, I kind of feel that there is just this. So we did some research last year, and the research said when you ask the general public, do you agree that the charitable organisations in this country need to be run to the very, very best professional standards that they can be? And, you know, 95% of the respondents agreed, absolutely. Then the next question we asked the public was, do you agree then, in order for those organisations to be run in the most professional manner, that you need to staff them with professionals who know how to run an organisation? And 75% agreed with that. And then the third question we asked them was, well, do you agree then to get the best professionals to organise run these organisations, that they should be paid what we would be paid in the commercial world? And then the respondents said only 41% agreed with that. So we have to address this issue of, you know, the salaries. When you look at a fundraising department, you know, the cost to raise money, it costs money to generate vital funds. There is no other sector. So some of the larger charities who invest in fundraising, and that includes paying the fundraising professionals working within that charity to raise those vital funds, the return on that investment is sometimes four times, five times the amount. You simply don't get those kind of returns in the commercial sector. So it is vitally important that you invest in the proper professional individuals and best practices so that these organisations can raise those vital funds.
It's a big challenge to get that message across to people, because I suppose what most people look at is when they think of charities, they think of volunteers, and you'll have people saying, but I volunteer my time, it doesn't cost them any money. I go out and I raise money by doing X, Y and Z. Why should it cost them money? So I suppose part of it is communications. Part of it is an issue of trust. I think you referred to it earlier, rehab, CRC, the trust that people had in charities, that kind of blind faith that people had in charities was completely shattered. Is part of your remit, or is it part of what you do to try and rebuild that trust in fundraising and how funds are spent and the good work the charities are doing?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and for any organisation, but in particular a charity, you are trading on trust, and you're trading on public trust. But I suppose the focus, I feel very strongly that the focus needs to shift away from how much is that overhead, how much are you spending of my money that I donate to you, to actually what's the outcome of the donation? Because the public in Ireland are extremely generous, and we need to shift that conversation away from how much is the overhead, that fundraising department, are they an overhead? They should be running and working as volunteers. To actually, what's the outcome that we're changing on the ground? What lives are we changing? You know, what diseases are we curing? How many? So the flip side of, if these organisations were not raising the money that they are raising, what would Ireland look like today?
But maybe we need a different debate around it. Maybe the overhead, it's not the overhead, it's the percentage of the overhead. The percentage of the donation that goes to support the overhead, irrespective of what the overhead is. But there's also a much bigger issue, I think, and we're not going to get into it today, about what work charities should actually be doing. Should they be funding research at all? Is that not a government job? Is that not an EU job? I wanted to come back to the whole fundraising area, though, more specifically, because I'm conscious that we've had this massive economic downturn, which must have seriously affected every charity's, every organisation's ability to raise money, because people just didn't have money in their pockets. And I know people would say, say that where they used to give a tenner to something, they then had to give a fiver because they still wanted to support the cause, but it was less. Have you seen a return? Is there an increase in the amount of funding that's coming into voluntary sector now at this stage?
There is. I mean, the belts were really tightened a few years ago, and understandably so. Again, we do an annual tracking, and last year donations were up, public donations were up on the previous year, but not only up, I suppose, across the board, but the actual amount that people were donating was increasing, which is really, really encouraging. So we're actually in the process at the moment of doing this annual tracker. So what we do is we measure, we ask the public what the donations they gave for the month of December, because that is the busiest time in fundraising. So we use that as an annual benchmark. So we are hoping to see, again, the generosity of the public to continue in their giving patterns for last year. So we'll have those findings published in the next couple of weeks.
I assume that the Irish people will never lose their ability to actually give money to good causes that they support. In terms of coming back to your new appointment last August, forward to August of this year, or August 5 years' time, what would you like to have achieved within a 12-month and a five-year period?
Wow, great question. In the next 12 months, I am a big believer in creating a consolidated single voice for our sector. It's a small sector and we need to be more coherent in how we respond to things. So I would love to see an organisation, or where what I bring to the table in terms of Fundraising Ireland and what the fundraising, I suppose, community, a sense of, in 12 months' time, I suppose, having a clear voice where the public understand the value and the importance of fundraising and fundraising within the charity sector. And within a five-year scale, I suppose, to have brought the voice of our sector onto the national agenda, so that the media, so that the public, so that government, so that people understand, because at the moment, people simply don't understand. There's a lot of confusion out there around overheads, salaries, how much of my money is going to donations, and that has to be completely demystified. And you can only do that by having a sector that operates in a completely transparent way, and that responds to questions in a consistent manner, and is able to respond with a single voice and a single approach from the sector.
I think you probably hit on it when you said consistency. One of your difficulties, I would imagine, is there are so many charities, they're fighting so many good fights on so many different fronts, that there is a lack of that coherence, that one single voice. Is there a willingness by the charity sector to join together to create a campaign which says it's not about our individual, and you're back to fundraising, and you'll be in trouble for fundraising for things like this, but is there a willingness for all charities to come together and say, really, we need to do almost a public education campaign about who we are, what we do, what is ethical, what we stand over, what we don't, how we use your money? Is there a willingness
out
there?
There absolutely is. And but I think it's absolutely vital. You've actually summed up exactly what we do need to do. And I look forward to coming back and talking to you about our success on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. We will leave it on that happy note, and I will look forward to your report card in due course.
Thanks, Alan.
Lucy Masterson, Chief Executive Fundraising Ireland, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Mediascope Show with Ellen Gunning on 103.2 Dublin City FM.
Welcome back. I'm joined in studio by Paul Davis, author of a new book called More: How You Can Get More Clients, More Fees and More Time. Sounds intriguing. You're very welcome to the studio, Paul.
Hi, Ellen. How are you?
Now, I'm thinking about all of these PR consultants and event managers who are listening this afternoon. This book really is for them. It's geared to professional service providers, isn't it?
Primarily it is, yeah. Albeit that it can work for quite a majority of all businesses. I've particularly geared this particular book for people in professional services.
Now, I'm going to start at the very back of the book.
Absolutely.
Okay. The back cover says, quote, "If you don't like networking to find new clients and have tried advertising and obtained poor results, this book is for you."
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You've got tell me more, because I think all businesses thrive and survive on networking and advertising.
Yeah.
This is the alternative approach?
Yeah, well, it's not taken away from networking. Once you go through the book and you have your processes in place and you have a way of how you're actually going to target market, well, then networking, it's going to boost your networking skills, to be quite honest with you. But where I suppose I started off with, I'm an introvert by background, or by personality, and what I had to do over the years was devise a system whereby I could actually get clients coming to my door without having to go out and network, because me walking into a networking room is just, I just don't like doing it.
That's very interesting. Okay, so you had to develop these, yeah, this structure, or exactly, these tricks of the trade, if you like, to suit your personality type.
So what I originally researched going back many, many years was I went to the States, went to the UK and many places over in Europe to find out, okay, what were people doing from an internet marketing point of view? And a lot of the mentors that I worked with were making serious money online through the websites by selling information products. So I took their systems and how they actually marketed it online and implemented it for my own business as professional service. And it worked. Quite simply worked.
I love the idea, and you just mentioned it there, of actually bringing people to your door.
Yeah.
That's the dream. How do you bring people to your door?
Well, if we take the basis of, let's just say the website as a tool, and it's not just one tool. There's many ways of how you can do it, but let's just take the website. People are searching online continuously every single day for particular keyword terms. So I operate, so some of my keyword terms, for example, will be business coach or business mentor or business consultant. All right. So every single day, people are entering those terms. If my website is optimized to have those keywords within my website, well, then I'm bringing them to my website. So therefore, people are every single day looking for, say, a business coach. They're coming to my website.
And this is above and beyond the Google advertising. This is sort of a natural search.
Yeah,
okay.
Natural search. So therefore, once I get them to my website, I've literally only got 2 to 3 seconds to convert them or to engage them in what I do for businesses. So there's
is a very tight window, 2 to 3 seconds.
But it can be done. It can be done. If primarily what you're looking at is if you're able to answer a question for somebody that's doing a search online, well, then now you have their engagement on your website. What a lot of businesses do is on their homepage, they will sell themselves, and it's all about them. It's all about the services that they provide, but very rarely it's about the client, the customer. What is it that they want? What is it that, what's the problem that they're trying to solve?
So give me an example, even from your own website. What do you find when you come onto that homepage? How do you answer a question that you don't know I've asked?
Yeah, well, on the homepage, basically on my current website, what you have is all the language is geared towards how we can make your business work better for you.
Okay, so you're actually saying now that you're here.
Yeah. This is how we can
would
make
solve
your
whatever
for you.
Problem it was you came to us with.
Yeah. Rather than most people, like I would work with a lot of solicitors, accountants, consultants, and most of their websites will go on the premise of, hi, this is such and such a company. We've been in business since 1975. We're a firm of X number of employees and so on. Visitors don't really care about that right now. All they want is their solution.
That's the kind of stuff you find out afterwards. It's like they look like they're good. Yeah. Now let's see, have they been around? Are they legit?
Exactly. Yeah.
Who works with them or whatever?
Yeah.
Is that the most common mistake that businesses make? That they get
on their website,
wrong?
Yeah. On the website it is. Absolutely.
So not networking, you're trying to drive people to your website. That's how you get them to your door?
That's how you get them to it's one avenue to get them to your door. What I also do is I would do a lot of workshops, training events, speaking events right around the country and in the UK. And really what you're doing is you're giving them value. So, for example, content that will be in the book right now at the moment, I would be giving those talks for many years over to different audiences. And through that, you're given value content. And by them being exposed to you, now they know that you're credible. They know that you can answer their questions. You know that you can help them. So therefore, what they want to do is engage with yourself. So they'll either go to your website or they will ask you questions or they will send you an email, connect with you on LinkedIn. So you're bringing them through multitude of different avenues.
So giving away the information that you spent years building up that's now natural in your head that you think nothing
Absolutely.
Of, but that other people go, oh my God, how does he know all that?
Yeah.
Actually brings people back to you as the source of that information.
Absolutely does. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Tell me about, I love the chapter on acres of diamonds.
Yeah.
Diamonds word, copy. tell me about acres of diamonds.
Well, I suppose what I put in the book, and a lot of what I put in the book, I use metaphors for explaining a particular concept, something that's complex, but people remember metaphors. Okay, so when I'm going,
the book is very good on it, I must say. It's full of these lovely little stories. Oh, yeah, now I know. Now I've got it. Yeah.
And you remember it. That's the thing. So a lot of clients that I would go into, first of all, they may have been in business for quite a number of years. They would have clients and customers that they would have worked with for many years and worked with them really well. They've had a good relationship with and all that kind of side of things. But the vast majority of clients that I would work with or go into on day one, they've never asked their clients for a referral. They've never asked for more business. So Acres of Diamonds is all about, there's diamonds on your doorstep, and with doing very, very little work, you can actually get more business out of the existing resources that you already have.
It's a very interesting one. The other story that I loved was the one about the dinner plate. You have to share that with listeners. I just adored that.
Okay, well, the dinner plate, I suppose, comes from the point of view of that. And again, a lot of clients that I work with is that they try and price their services low. All right. But what you need to get across is the perception of value to your customer.
Actually, is this, sorry for interrupting you now, I haven't asked you to tell the story, but is this a new thing post economic downturn? Because in the economic downturn, everybody seemed to be talking about pitch low, get cash low.
Yeah, they wanted value.
And now people seem to be saying, oh, pitch back high again.
Well, okay, one thing, fee rates are increasing. They are definitely on the increase. It wasn't so much, my message to all my clients during the recession time was, don't reduce your prices. Absolutely do not reduce your prices, give more value.
Okay.
And that's the difference.
Sorry. And that brings us back to the dinner plate.
So therefore, what you want to get through, so I suppose the story of the dinner plate for those that haven't read the book yet is a case of, well, if I presented a dinner plate to you and I asked you, you know, if I bought it, for example, in a shop like, say, Tesco's or Debenhams, how much would you pay for it? And the typical answer I would get back is somewhere in the region of 10 euros. If I said I bought it in a car boot sale, people would probably say, well, you probably paid about maybe 2 euros or 5 euros. But if I said that I bought it in Harrods or Brown Thomas, people will automatically say, no, you probably paid about 25 to 30 euros for that particular plate. Nothing's changed. The plate is exactly the same, but it's the perception for the customer, but equally it's how you convey our message to the customer. What is the difference in the perception? And that's how you present yourself, your business, your website, your marketing materials, everything about your business. It's how it's perceived. When you walk into Brown Thomas, it's a completely different feeling compared to, say, walking into Lidl or Aldi. Now, there's no different. I'm not saying there's no reason why you wouldn't shop in Aldi or Lidl compared to Brown Thomas. It's not about that. It's a case of, you're getting a completely different experience when you're walking into each store. So the question for yourself as a professional service provider or as any other business, what is the value that you want to convey to your customers and where do you want to position yourself in the marketplace? So if you want to be at the high end of the Brown Thomas's or the Harrods, or you want to be middle ground, or you want to be low priced, well then, if you're going to be low priced, there's going to be a rush to the bottom line. And many, many businesses, it's all based on volume. It's the only way they can actually increase their profits. So it's not a case of pitching yourself at the low price. Try and go middle end to high end rather than low priced.
It is interesting that, as you say, there's nothing wrong with any of the stores that you mentioned, but you expect a different experience if you walk into Lidl than you expect in Brown Thomas or Dunn Stores to Brown Thomas or whatever. They all pitch differently in your mind.
They do.
It's a mental picture of what you can expect. One of the sections in your book also talks about managing your time. I love this. We all spend all of our time, of which we have none, talking about how do we manage our time. But you actually said in the book, there are never enough hours in the day to get everything done, and then proceeded to say, but let me tell you how you manage that. Absolutely. So share it with people. How do you manage to do everything with the same limited 24 hours?
A lot of it is coming down to, A, on one hand, your psychology. Okay, so it's about how can we boost the psychology in the individual first. So the way we do that is, rather than trying to focus on a to-do list that might have 20, 30, 50 items onto the to-do list, to me, that's just a wish list. There's no way you're going to get, and everybody will answer, there's no way you'll get through all the 25 items in the 1 day or the 1 week or even the 1 year, for example. So what we try and do is we boost the psychology by saying, okay, let's just focus in on the top three. So out of all the things that are on your to-do list, what are the top three things that you need to do right now? What are the urgent things? And what I mean by that is, you know, there would have been other material out there in relation to time management. What is the most urgent? What is the most important things to do and so on? But primarily, it's what are the top three things that you need to do today or this hour or this half a day? Then it's a case of zoning your diary over the actual week itself. When if you get to, say, lunchtime and you've done your top three things, what you're doing is, from a psyche point of view, you've actually built your confidence. Say, actually, do you know what? I feel better about myself because I've actually done the top three. What happens with most people is they get to the end of the day and they never look at what they've achieved. They've actually looked at what everything else that's on the to-do list. So they're finishing.
That's really interesting, do they? They look at the negatives rather than the positives.
They look at the negatives, yeah. The vast majority of people look at the negatives.
I love to-do lists because I love looking back and going, ticked, ticked, ticked. Oh, I'm groovy. And it might have been three things on a list of 30.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'll rock out of the office happy that I got three things done. Most people will see the 27.
Yeah, they will, okay. Once you've got your top three, then it's a case of, okay, how can we actually zone our diary to make sure that we can lock ourselves off? So, for example, if it's business development that we need to focus in on, well, there's no point in trying to do administration, business development, client work and everything else at the exact same time. Multitasking is out the door. Now, I know females will always say multitasking, they can do it and it's great. Us men can't.
With respect to females, I think it's a different kind of multitasking. We can actually pick up the kids, do the shopping, wash the hair and arrange dinner at the same
time.
Guys are going, what was point number one?
Exactly.
But
exactly.
In business, I agree with you. If it's something that requires time, it's not
focus,
a case of,
if
you need to focus on business development or strategy, you really can't do that while you're doing seven
no,
other things.
No, you can't. No.
So it's blocking out time that allows you to do it.
Exactly. So it's blocking out time to zone your diary within the week itself that you're covering three areas. So business development, client work and administration. If you cover those three areas in the week, well, then you're keeping your business going on an ongoing basis.
And just speaking of administration, it's not really administration, but the other thing that struck me from your book was you put an emphasis on support systems.
Yeah.
And you said that you in business have always had a business coach because you like to have somebody to report to.
Absolutely.
Which is kind of a contradiction if you work for yourself.
Well, okay, most people go into self-employment because they want their freedom. But however, what they'll find is that they don't have anybody that's accountable to. But primarily for me, it's around how can I be stretched? So if I want to hit a target, say, of let's say 2016 now, if I want to increase my turnover by X percentage, who's there? Who am I accountable? If I am self-employed, but at the end of the day, I'm not accountable to anybody else. So if I don't hit my target, well, then what difference is it going to make? The other thing is where I might get blockages in a sense of there's certain things that I may want to do. But again, if I'm not being stretched by a mentor to actually get over those blockages and work through the fears and all kinds of things, I'll keep pushing out. I'll keep procrastinating in not doing it. It's human nature at the end of the day. I'm no different to anybody else that's out there. So any of the barriers that I face, you know, if there's a mentor or a coach from a sports field point of view, or anything else that you're doing out there from a fitness point of view or a sports point of view, why wouldn't you have a coach or a mentor in business? It just doesn't make sense. I love the idea.
I actually thought when I was reading it, it's like the New Year's resolutions.
Yeah.
If you don't tell anybody what they are, nobody knows whether you're them or not.
Exactly.
But if you actually tell them, it's out there. Now you've got to confess
you
that
have
you
to
reached
do it.
Or you didn't. Paul Davis, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The book is called How to Get More Clients, More Fees and More Time. It's published by Oak Tree Press. It's in all good bookstores now. And my guest has been Paul Davis, its author this afternoon. Well now, that's all I have for you for this week. If you've information you'd like to share with us, please send an email to mediascope@dublincityfm.ie. My thanks to Paul Davis and Lucy Masterson, and thanks to you for being with me this week. Next up is our musical Islands with Euan O'Doherty. Until next Tuesday, bye-bye.